everybody, Alex Newman here with The New American, and I am with Chris Wyatt, a retired colonel from the U.S. military, also spent a lot of time doing intelligence work. He's also the CEO and the principal of the Indaba Africa Group. He's got a lot of experience in Africa and all around the world. It's just incredible the amount of travels he's done. Chris, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Chris, one of the areas that you have focused on a lot and that you have a lot of expertise on is South Africa. I think the overwhelming supermajority of Americans are totally clueless about what's going on there. They know that evil apartheid came down in the 1990s, and now we can celebrate, and that's all they know. So what has happened in those years since that happened?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because most of the developed world looks at Africa through a lens of April 27th of 1994, and that's when time stopped. Nothing happened after that. And that's a real problem. But since that time, the majority government under the African National Congress, which was one of the liberation movements, of course, if you went to South Africa, you'd think that they were the only ones because they've rewritten history. But they were just one of the actors, one of many, including the Pan-African Congress and many other actors. Not that I'm a fan of the Pan-African Congress, just saying that they're another actor that was actually important. And the Black Consciousness Movement, the Black Sash Movement, many other things in South Africa. What happened, though, is that the country started off on a relatively good foot, in no small measure because Nelson Mandela made it pretty clear to the country that reconciliation was the key. And there was a reconciliation period, but I would have to say it wasn't really a genuine reconciliation period, because a lot of people on both sides, the far left and far right, are not necessarily happy with what came out. They had this thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which has been held up as the standard for Chile and for Rwanda and other places. Frankly, I think Rwanda did a better job with their own court system trying the genocidaires than... Anyway, so South Africa, that honeymoon period lasted for a few years. They actually got a number of people onto the tax rolls who hadn't been paying taxes in the past, under Trevor Manuel, who was the finance minister, and the country started getting economic growth. Now, never the growth it needed to overcome pervasive poverty. South Africa needs 6 to 8% annual GDP growth just to catch up for a sustained period of years, and they haven't been able to do that. They got 6.5% 1 or 2 years, but the economy grew, and people thought things were improving, I mean, generally speaking. And then Jacob Zuma became the president. He's the former head of the intelligence for Mkhonto Isizwe, or MK as it's known. That's the armed wing of the African National Congress during the liberation struggle. He knows where all the dirt is, where all the bodies are buried, and so that's how he became president when they unseated. Now, here's the irony with South Africa is that the president of South Africa is not elected by the people. It's basically a parliamentary system. So the members of parliament select the president. So no one ever voted for Mandela to be president. They voted for him to be their member of parliament, but that's not even true either because he's on a list. So they vote for a parliamentary. It's just a crazy system. But they think it works for them. I don't think it works for them very well. Anyway, bottom line is that Zuma became president when they unseated a guy named Thabo Mbeki because he became increasingly unpopular within his own party because he was kind of arrogant and a technocrat. So they pushed him aside over a decade ago, and Zuma came in. And then it was Our Turn to Eat. If you're familiar with that book by Michaela Wrong about Kenya corruption, it's Our Turn to Eat. And that's exactly what's been happening in South Africa the last 15 years, is the African National Congress has become progressively more corrupt, inept, and they chase qualified people out of the country based on the wrong skin pigmentation. Most of South Africa's best talented engineers in electrical field and things like that are working in France in the nuclear industry or working in Japan and have gone abroad because they've been chased out of jobs. And this is important because much of the economy is controlled by the government. It's ostensibly a capital market-based system, but in reality it's not. It's a very, very much a social government system, which ironically is the same system the National Party established under apartheid. Mm-hmm. So you had patronage under apartheid, which favored the white Afrikaans-speaking population, and now you have patronage under the ANC, which favors the majority black population, and specifically mostly the Zulu and the Xhosa peoples. It's crazy.
And there's been more and more in the South African press and in the South African government about it's time to go into the next phase of the National Democratic Revolution. Now we need to start expropriating land, farms, businesses, capital, shares, I mean, everything. Do you think there's a risk of South Africa going full-blown communist? And what does that look like? And how long ago were the seeds for that planted, if you think that's where it's headed?
Well, ironically, I would say the seeds for the... First off, you should know that, and the audience should know that every senior member of the African National Congress is a card-carrying member of the South African Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And they have been since liberation, and call it liberation in 1994. So
even Mandela was on the Central Committee. Yeah.
He was, yeah. In fact, the Minister of Higher Education right now, Blaise Nzimande, is the Secretary General of the South African Communist Party. So they are one and the same in that way. In fact, they have this thing called the Tripartite Alliance, which is the labor unions under COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, which is the biggest group of trade unions, the African National Congress, and the South African Communist Party. So it's a little triad there. The South African Communist Party has never had more than 50 or 60,000 members, and most people just join it just to say they're in it. But they're incredibly influential because all the top ANC members are from that. But this National Democratic Revolution you're talking about, I don't know if that's genuine. I just think that the ANC, I mean, when I say I think, this isn't just, you know, I'm just pontificating here. It's actually analysis and experience here. Is that from my perspective, the ANC has just become such reprobates, and they're not willing to deal with corruption in their midst. I mean, during the pandemic, we've seen pervasive theft of state funds, and it's been enabled by international lending institutions. The International Monetary Fund gave $4.3 billion in 2020. The African Development Bank gave $285 million. And the new BRICS Bank, or the new development bank, the BRICS Bank, which they're a member of, gave $1 billion. So that's 5.6 billion or 90 billion rand at the time. A lot of people in South Africa are talking about money that was looted that the government had, but they're bankrupt. They have no money. They have junk bond status. They can't even borrow. If it wasn't for a loan from the World Bank that just occurred, another loan they just got at basically 1.1% interest, so that's a gift after inflation. You're paying back less than you borrowed. They would have gone under a long time ago. It's a crazy situation. Basically, in some respects, industry is kind of controlled by an oligarchy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the phrase that's being bandied about by race hustlers, that's the phrase I like to use rather than call them racist, because if you call someone a racist in South Africa, you can't prove it. You could be sued. So you got to be careful. Now, words matter in South Africa. And race hustling is what people are doing. They're using race to divide people. And it's just reprehensible. And it's being done primarily against the minority population, which isn't just white South Africans. You've got about just under 5 million white South Africans, which are about half of them are the community known as Afrikaners, so descended from the French Huguenots and the Dutch early settlers, but mostly Germans, actually, who arrived in the Western Cape. And then you have this community of minority, which is much larger, known as the colored community. And no, it's not 1950s, you know, racist America colored. That's actually a term that's a term of endearment for people who are from that mixed race community. And their origins go back to the 17th century. And you're very recognizable, for the most part, with Dutch or French surnames, usually French or Dutch Calvinist religion. They speak Afrikaans. And that grouping is probably about 8 million South Africans. And they are also marginalized and pushed aside by the ANC, even though people from those ethnic groups are part of the ANC. And then you have the group known collectively as the Indians, South Asians who came over mostly in the 19th century to work the sugar plantations in KwaZulu-Natal province on the East Coast, which is tropical and subtropical. They stayed, and that community is over 1.2 million people today. So you've got about 12, 14 million people in the country that the ruling party doesn't care about and excludes them from everything. They're excluded from doing business. So when they have this thing called broad-based black economic empowerment, which is simply a racist piece of legislation. So you can't bid for a contract unless your company is majority owned by someone with the correct skin pigmentation. Mm-hmm. Now, if that isn't racist, I don't know what is. I mean, let's turn the script around 30 years ago, and if you're white, that's the right skin color. If you're black, you can't get a contract with the government. Well, now it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. And the world is not paying attention. The world is asleep at the wheel. But then the world is asleep at the wheel on many issues, including the Ukraine.
Yeah, they are. And I do want to spend some time talking to Ukraine if we have time. But there's so many things to ask you about South Africa. You know, do you think they're going to succeed with this expropriation? Do you think they're going to move forward with that? Are they really going to just start going to take people's land without paying them? What is that going to lead to? And how does that fit into the independence movement on the Cape? Do you see that as
secession?
Yeah, for the Western Cape to secede? You know, I spent a lot of time living in the Cape. I know a lot of people there.
It's a lovely place.
It is. But do you think that they will be able to secede? Do you think the central government would let them? Where do you think it's going from here?
Okay, well, let's start with the Cape secession, then we'll come back to land expropriation, which is a fairy tale in itself, which is going to irritate a lot of my hate-wanking people that watch my program. I like to call them hate-wankers. But anyway, so the secession thing, there's a big secession movement, and I mean big. There's hundreds of thousands of people in the Western Cape that support it, and we're only talking a population of, what, I think it's about 6 million in the Western Cape total. And it's being portrayed by those opposed to it as a white minority racist, you know, thing to move away. But there's only 18% of the population of that region is white. Now, that's double what it is in most of the country, but it's still a low number. The majority of the population in the Western Cape is colored, mixed race, who speak Afrikaans. The secession movement has three major groups. You have United Liberty Alliance, and you have the Cape Exit Group, and there's another one. And I've interviewed all the leaders of these different groups. They're not political parties. They're just civic organizations. And what they're seeking is a referendum on Cape Secession to leave South Africa. Now, there's a lot of parallels with this. You've got Catalonia and Spain, which didn't work out too well, and you've got a number of other places that are seeking to move away. But in those other places, it's typically an irredentist movement where people are trying to rejoin, you know, another majority in another country or something like that, like in the Donbass with Luhansk and Donetsk. These are primarily Russian occupied or settled regions that used to be part of Russia before they were given by Khrushchev. So they want to rejoin Russia. That's an irredentist movement. But in the Western Cape, there's no irredentist movement. It's simply people who live in the Western Cape who share a common culture for the most part, not exclusively, but Afrikaans language, and then a grouping of people who are tired of their money going to the national government and nothing coming back, and they think they can do well on their own. Now, if you ask me the technical question, could the Western Cape secede and survive? Yeah, it could. And people also ask me, well, what do they do if the South African army comes after them? Well, you and I and five people here in the street could probably defeat the South African army today. I'm embellishing, but not by much, folks. It's really in a sad state of repair and disrepair. 21% of the South African Air Force aircraft are currently operational. In the late 1990s, the South African government under the African National Congress decided that they needed to modernize the military, which was one of the best equipped, well, in Africa, the best equipped, obviously, but one of the best in the world, one of the best group of fighters. And so what they decided to do was buy Type 209 diesel submarines from the Germans and cruisers, and also Hawk lead-in fighter trainers from the Brits, and then Gripen fighters, which is a fantastic interceptor and fighter aircraft. But the South African military didn't need new fighters and submarines and cruise ships. What they needed was new prime movers, trucks and, you know, armored personnel carriers and ranges and ammunition and barracks repaired and things like that for the army. And ironically, most of what the South African military has done since 1994 is peacekeeping abroad. And who's done it? The army, except when they're HIV positive, then they had to take soldiers and sailors individually from the different services. So it's the Western Cape could secede, and it could be a viable economically. They've got a huge wine industry. They've got technology. South Africa's only nuclear power plant is located in the Western Cape. It's got the capabilities, a huge tourism industry, what's left of it after lockdown, I should say. It has a lot going for it. It has a world-class universities, although they've been poisoned with the wokeism that's been going on, but Stellenbosch and also UCT, University of Cape Town, Rhodes University, all located there. It has a vibrant life, and economically and politically it could succeed with secession. But would the ANC be willing to let it go? Well, one problem here is the parliament's located in Cape Town. Of course, the parliament building burned down recently.
Very conveniently.
Well, it burned down because they haven't had a head of security, a permanent head of security, in nearly 5 years. Mm. She was relieved. The woman was there. There was a bogus investigation against her, which turned up nothing. And no one's been she was fired, and then no one's been rehired. She hasn't been rehired to be the head of security. So no one was in charge of security. I don't know, kind of like in January last year in D.C.
Yeah.
Seemed like nobody's in charge of security, and we'll just leave that there unless you want to go into it. But anyway, I'm just saying, 100 D.C. Capitol Police, that's all it shows up for a demonstration with five permits issued by the Capitol Police and 500,000 people? I'm just saying. Anyway, but the Parliament building, which was over a century old, just burned. It was horrific. I actually covered that live as it was going on from South Africa.
Wow.
It's really a sad situation. But it's a combination of there was no one in charge, the guards weren't there, they were asleep, there were cops that had cameras, they weren't monitoring the cameras, and the place burned for like 3 hours before anyone even discovered it. Initially, the government tried to cover it up and say, well, no, the firemen responded within 6 minutes. True. 6 minutes from the time someone finally notified them, 3 hours after the fire started. It's a sad statement. So the parliament would have to relocate from there. Another question people goes, well, what about the Navy? Because the Navy headquarters for South Africa is in Simonstown, which is in the Western Cape.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely area, by the way. That's where the little penguins are at, if you're in South Africa. They just waddle around down there. But the Navy, that's a very simple thing. The Western Cape say, we don't want your ships. They're poorly maintained anyway. Just take them over to Durban or Port Elizabeth, and you can have them. And as far as the military, there's plenty of people in the Western Cape who serve in the military, even the previous military or the current military, that could form a police force and military. So it's possible, it's viable. The question is, would the ANC allow it? Would the international community recognize it? One of the problems with the African Union is that it has the same principle the Organization African Union had. A founding principle of the OAU in 1963 was that they would recognize all borders. And then for 50 years we had lots of people whine about, well, we inherited colonial borders. Well, yeah, and then you said they're sacrosanct, you can't change them. That was your decision, your 63 members in Africa. You know, if you wanted to change the boundaries in Cameroon and Nigeria, you had a chance to do it. But they refused. So the African Union is kind of the same mind, although they're more flexible. We've seen Eritrea become an independent country. From Ethiopia, we've seen South Sudan become a country. And the African Union recognizes the independence of Western Sahara, although Morocco doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a problem. So the African Union might be amenable to it, but I would be shocked to see that. So practically, it can happen. Politically, it's an open-ended question, I think. And then we got land expropriation. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So tell me, do you think that's going to happen? I know I get a lot of emails from people in South Africa that are very concerned about this. Do you think that'll eventually move forward, either with the EFF getting more share in parliament or the ANC just going ahead? I know a lot of their leaders have said they support it. Do you think it's going to move forward?
Well, let's give a little backdrop first to explain what's going on here. First off, the land issue in South Africa is pretty much just a lie. Let me explain why. Were people defrauded of their land under apartheid government? Absolutely. Was it morally wrong? Absolutely. Should they be compensated? Absolutely. Guess what? Almost all of them happened. Mm-hmm. What? Yeah, yeah. No, from 1995 to 1999, there was an open window for anyone to make a claim. By the way, it wasn't just black South Africans that lost land. White South Africans did too, but most of them were compensated with other land. So a lot of farmers in what became the Bantustan or homeland of Bophuthatswana, which is located on the border with Botswana and a bunch of little pieces and parcels here and there, a lot of cattle ranchers and farmers up there had their land expropriated by the government, but they were compensated with land in KwaZulu-Natal. I mean, they've been there for 150, 200 years, so it's, you know, it's anyway. But it was mostly black South Africans. In fact, 3.5 million black South Africans in the 1980s alone were relocated off of land that they lived on. Mm-hmm. Whether they had title to it or not, it's another story, but they were relocated, and it was wrong. So from that window for 5 years, 75,000 plus land claims were filed. Now, it was a very generous situation because what they said is that, like, you and I could have been defrauded of land. We might have been old enough to have owned land, you know, and our land could have been taken. But a lot of people, their parents or their grandparents had their land stolen. And they're dead. They've passed on. What they decided that the CODESA summit, which is the Convention for Democratic South Africa and negotiations to end apartheid and have an all-race election, that convention which took place, which, by the way, was they tried to overrun it with some right-wing radicals, tried to stop it, but it didn't work out. That convention, there was an agreement made by all parties, the Pan-African Congress, the ANC, the ruling National Party, and others, that land claims could not go back before 1910. Now, why does that matter? And this is something no one discusses, but this is a practical reason. Whether people like it or not, land acquired through warfare is a legitimate means of, that's legitimate means of political discourse. It may be very unpalatable. Look at Ukraine right now, but it is a legitimate, recognized means of political discourse. It's hopefully the last line of discourse. Sometimes it isn't the last line. And in this case, let's say for Putin, it wasn't the last line. It was kind of an early thing. But if you conquer land during a war, that's legitimate historically. People accept that. 1910 matters because there was no country of South Africa before 1910. It never existed. And people are like, what? The Union of South Africa Act, the British Parliament issued this after defeating the Boers, the Afrikaners. They're now called Afrikaners, but the term then was Boer, which means farmer in Dutch. They had two independent republics called the Orange Free State and the Transvaal Republic. Though they fought two wars against the British, the first time they were successful, and then they fought a second war, which was the most famous one from 1899 to 1902. It was mostly a guerrilla war, open battles. The Boers defeated the Brits repeatedly, but they were numerically inferior, so they were worn down, and they resorted to guerrilla warfare. The Brits, in response, resorted to the first modern concentration camps, arresting their wives, their children. We had thousands of children and women and elderly die in concentration camps from typhus and dysentery and starvation. It was horrific, and they weren't alone. A lot of black South Africans also died because they were the workers or they're their allies, and they were taken to the camps as well. And they burned all their farms and just made these people destitute, which all plays in the modern history. So before 1910, there was the Cape Colony. There was the Zulu Nation that was still independent. There was the Orange Free State, the Transvaal. All of these things were merged in 1910, and that's when South Africa began. So that's the modern day. So all these parties agree that anything before 1910 is the sands of history. It's all sands through the hourglass. And that's legitimate, in my view. You know, I mean, we can't go back to, you know, 1600, whenever, when Montezuma was defeated and say, give the land to the Aztecs. That just isn't going to work in the modern context. And by the same token, you can't go back to, you know, 1300 or 1100 in the Baltic states and say, those Teutonic knights took our land. You know, it's ours. I mean, people won't admit that the Jews were chased out of Israel and they have a 5,000-year title to it. They won't accept that. So why will they accept these other things? Anyway, so it was a good decision, I think, and it was a pragmatic decision. And most of those claims have been settled. Now, they were settled for financial compensation mostly, which was it enough? That's another question. I would agree it wasn't enough to compensate people for their land because some of this land is quite valuable now. But at least the approach is there. When Zuma became president, another window opened up as illegitimate. They had 141,000 additional claims that were put in. Most of them are fraudulent or duplicate claims people put in the past that they weren't happy with the outcome. So the system has been clogged up. But the bottom line on land is that there's a mechanism in the South African Constitution right now. It's been there all along. It's in the Constitution since the late 1990s. They can expropriate land whenever they want with compensation. Mm-hmm. They don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
They don't want to pay for it. And so that's the problem. They don't want to pay for the land, and that's a real issue here. It's just more, you know, our turn to eat sort of thing. Here's the other thing. The ANC says they want to put 1 million black Africans on farms in a few years. The rest of the world is reducing the people working on farms with mechanization, automation, and becoming more efficient at food production. They want to put people, in my view, and in perpetual poverty. Mm-hmm. We're having small-scale holdings instead of being large industrial farmers. The key to South African prosperity is education. Education today, for most South Africans, is worse than it was under apartheid, and that's sad.
Yeah.
So that's kind of sad.
Yep, there's a lot of things. Life expectancy has gone down quite significantly. It's quite interesting. Another one, a question I want to ask you about what's going on in South Africa, and I know we're almost running out of time, but the influence of, first of all, the United States and the U.S. intelligence community, you know, in Rhodesia and South Africa and all the things that have been going on there, and also now, more recently, the influence of communist China. Let's start with U.S. influence. Do you think it was positive, and can you talk a little bit about the role of the U.S. State Department, the U.S. intelligence community going back through the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s?
Well, that's a lot, but what I can say is that the U.S. had a role in Southern Africa. Mm. And the irony is that we were perceived as supporting the minority apartheid government. Mm-hmm. And then by many people in that government, we were perceived as not supporting them and supporting liberation movements. Mm-hmm. The sad irony for all of this is that the liberation movements across Southern Africa, kind of like Giap in Vietnam, he actually approached the United States. You know, they wanted to ally with the U.S. when he was fighting for independence in Vietnam from the French. And we had an American Army officer that was there, and it didn't happen. It's perhaps historically unfortunate it never happened. Vietnam would have rolled out differently potentially, but I don't even know if geopolitical would work. But same thing in South Africa and Rhodesia and Southwest Africa, which became Namibia and Mozambique and Angola. The U.S. found itself on a side of history supporting the colonial powers that were there and then their offspring, South African government, the governments elsewhere. And what happened was, with no one to turn to, these movements looking for liberation looked where they could help, and that was East Germany, the Soviet Union, China, and that's where they found succor and refuge and support, and that's who they turned to. And we're living with the consequences of that today. Now, the U.S. intelligence played a role in South Africa and in the region, particularly for Rhodesia. We also, you know, with other actors, this isn't a state secret, the CIA was engaged in Angola. We supported Holton Roberto with the Front for National Liberation, the FNLA in Angola. He just died about 10 years ago, too. He'd been around for a long time. And that was definitely the wrong horse to back. If we're going to back a horse, we should have backed Jonas Savimbi at the beginning, because the Marxist government, of the MPLA, the Popular Movement for Liberation of Angola, they still rule to today. And they're also a very corrupt government, too. They just pilfer money, and most of the country is desperately poor. So the intelligence community and U.S. foreign policy in Africa, in Southern Africa, wasn't always on the right side. In the 1980s, under Chester Crocker, who was responsible for Africa in the State Department, we had this constructive engagement approach, and it was heavily criticized. Reagan was against sanctions on South Africa. That was also criticized. And people think that sanctions ended South Africa. No, the reason South Africa, the National Party, ended is for a couple reasons. For years, they convinced the minority white population that there were two real threats to their safety and their sovereignty, and that was the red threat and the black threat, the Swathava and the Ruihava. And so after many years of neighboring states having black-ruled governments that weren't imploding, and they weren't, you know, Botswana right on their border, you know, wasn't collapsing, and they had a reasonable democratic government, it was harder to sell the black threat. Plus, it was morally repugnant. People were tired of apartheid for many reasons. And then the other thing is that when the Berlin Wall collapsed and the Soviet Union disappeared, the raison d'etre, the reason for existing, was gone. But what people don't realize is that the National Party was very much a socialist party in many respects. It ran state industries like Sasol, the state oil producer that takes the Ribbentrop process to take coal and convert it into petroleum. They also had a state-owned airline, everything. The rail lines are all run by the state, which is still the case today. The national utility running the power, which is a disaster, was run by the state, but it worked effectively. The Afrikaners and the National Party, to their credit, when they used patronage, they at least hired competent people. The ANC doesn't hire competent people. It just hires people with loyalty. Mm-hmm. What matters in South Africa to get ahead is loyalty to Luthuli House. Luthuli House is the headquarters of the African National Congress, and if you're loyal to the party, then you're rolling in the hay. The State Department, since the end of apartheid, I think, has kind of been looking through glass houses. They think that things are wonderful in South Africa, and they're reporting. I've worked with many of these people there, and I've been there many, many times in official capacity. I think many of these people just really don't get what's happening in South Africa, or maybe they just don't care. Some do, but I don't think that back at Foggy Bottom, people really pay close enough attention to it. We, you know, the South Africa, just very quickly, so we wrap up here, South Africa traditionally has a political appointee. It's not a place where a career diplomat usually goes, sometimes, but oftentimes people like Jendai Fraser and most recently Lana Marks, who was not very popular. She spoke at CPAC this week.
Really?
I missed that. I was on a program for South Africa at the time, so I missed her speech. But these are political appointees, and sometimes political appointees are rock stars. They're really good at being diplomats. They really know what they're doing. And sometimes they're rocks. So I would say that our foreign policy in South Africa has been, in my view, a bit wrongheaded at times, and it really hasn't accomplished a whole lot. Other than keeping South Africans alive, we've spent billions of dollars providing antiretrovirals and money for development for education, which has helped somewhat. But I don't know that we've really accomplished the things we need to for the U.S. strategic interest there.
And I want to ask about China now. The ANC, in their foreign policy document some years ago, they said that communist China was the guiding lodestar of our struggle. And I understand the communist Chinese are working very closely now with the South African military, with the South African police service. I mean, they're like in everything now. They're buying up massive amounts of assets. And it's not just in South Africa. It's all over the continent and in America as well. So what do you think about the communist Chinese influence in South Africa and broader Africa? Is it a threat? How should it be dealt with, et cetera?
Well, I'm not one of these people that's a Sinophobe, and I'm also not a Sinophile. I'm not a fan or an opponent of China. I've worked with the Chinese in Africa. And in my view, if you understand what their motivation is or what they're up to, then you do it with clear view, and you can actually accomplish things in some situations, like in life.
What is their motivation, and what are they up to?
Well, now they want to be the world's preeminent unipolar power. Mm-hmm. That's pretty obvious. I mean, they have a larger Navy, capital ships, than we do. We have less than 400. They're over 500 now. We had a 600-ship Navy under Reagan. It's a shadow of what it once was. Now, they can't project their power in the same way we can, but it's just a matter of time. I mean, we've been busy sponsoring their entry into the World Trade Organization, knowing full well that they would never follow the rules and break them with informal tariffs and barriers and formal tariffs and barriers, bans on imports. You know, they've been working all the rules, and no one's held them to account. And this is the fault of corporate executives in this country, our government, under successive presidents. Bush went along and did the same with this. Obama deep into this. Trump made an effort, but he was distracted by so many things and fraudulent attacks against him, like the Russia collusion hoax and all these other things, that it really undermined his foreign policy in some respects. Nonetheless, he had some really big achievements. But by the way, I'm not a Trump person. I've got my issues with Donald Trump as well. In the interest of full disclosure, I did vote for him twice. Yep. First time, I was reluctant to, and I was wrong about what he was going to do. He actually governed, arguably, as the single most conservative one-term president in the U.S. history, I would argue. Anyway, and then Biden is just even more of a disaster with China, what's going on here. China and Africa is all over, and they're not always malicious actors, but they're also not in it just to do good and wonderful things most of the time. It's all for influence and access, and that's fine. We should do the same, and we do it. We do things. We do nice things for influence and access. There's nothing wrong with that. We should be responsive to the strategic interests of our sovereign state, and they are as well. And I think if you understand that, then you can deal with the Chinese. But there are a lot of things about the Chinese. You know, they don't care about corruption the way we do. I mean, if I bribe an official in South Africa on a contract, I could be prosecuted in the States. Yeah. That ain't going to happen in China. That's not going to happen. So, I mean, that's an advantage for them. Also, the state's all in, backs almost all their efforts. Now, there's a lot of private efforts outside of state control in China, which expand their influence. But overall, China is has been beneficial for Africa. But I would say that's just a matter of happenstance in some respects. You bring that much money, you bring that much attention, that much focus, you're bound to have some good spinoffs and good effects. But you also have terrible things. I've been in countries like Liberia where the Chinese had the World Bank loan and built the roads. And it was perfect for time for Bush to arrive for his visit to Liberia. There were wonderful roads. And then 2 months later, we had 6-foot potholes. They just fell apart just like that in the rain in there. And I've also been in places where they built parliamentary buildings, which are amazing. But in South Africa, I think that China is largely a force for negative for South Africans. They intrude in South Africa's domestic foreign policy. Twice they've intruded to stop the Dalai Lama from getting a visa to go to South Africa. I mean, how cool is the Dalai Lama? I mean, how could you not like the Dalai Lama? The guy supported the apartheid, anti-apartheid struggle for years. And he was a vocal opponent against apartheid. And he tried to go for World Racism Summit there. They denied him a visa because the Chinese communist overlords told him not to. Then he wanted to come for Desmond Tutu's birthday, for his 80th birthday or something like that. They denied a visa because they didn't want the Dalai Lama to have a world stage. So they use their influence to achieve what they want. They also have these big industrial parks in South Africa, which no one else is allowed to use. They have no taxation. There's some really wonky stuff going on with the Chinese. Now, that's not a I hate China comment. Mm-hmm. It's a statement of fact.
Yeah.
It's a statement of fact. I'd love to have a no-tax zone in South Africa where I could do business, but I'm not hooked up with the Chinese Communist Party and the ANC, so that's not going to happen.
Yeah. You have focused on what's happening in Ukraine. As we're recording this, Putin has invaded. The Ukrainians are resisting. The U.S. government's policy has been, I don't know, hard to exactly determine what it is.
Well, but we're leading from behind once again. So we're following the Europeans' lead after the fact. That's a bit late, just like in Libya. In Libya, we use the excuse of, we're not leading this operation. How is the U.S. not leading? This is crazy. Whether we should have gone in Libya is a whole different story. That's a different question. But if we're going to be involved, why are we in the back letting the Brits and French run the operation? I mean, we're not just here to, you know, to supply bread and bullets. That's you know, the U.S. is a unipolar power in the planet, although China's challenging for us for that now. Russia has designs on it, but having seen the performance of the Russian troops in the Ukraine, I don't think that Russia really can be one of the top polar powers right now. But the Chinese are challenging us. As far as what's happening in the Ukraine, we should go back to 2014 when, under Obama's administration, Putin was emboldened by American weakness. We see a president who goes and bows before the Saudi monarch. That's disgraceful. And then says America doesn't have exceptionalism. We're not unique. We're just another country. And really runs down a reputation abroad for his whole time as in office for 8 years. And most people not paid attention to it. There was a tangible impact to our diplomacy abroad. I served in our embassies when he was president those 8 years all over Africa. And you could see the changes in our foreign policy. Once people got past the whole idea, ooh, he's the first black president in Africa, and realized what he was actually doing. He wasn't doing nothing to help our foreign policy in Africa. They kind of woke up to that in Africa sooner than the rest of the world. But Americans and Western Europe didn't really pay attention. Our reputation was tarnished in so many ways under the administration. And this is an anti-Obama thing. I'm just stating my opinion and my analysis of what actually happened from having been in the trenches and seen it. Well, in 2014, the Russians invade Crimea, the most strategically important part of what belonged to the Ukraine. Now, it's almost all Russians live there, but that isn't germane. It was Ukrainian soil. They invaded, unjustified, they annexed it, and the Obama administration, Joe Biden, and Barack Obama, this was their reaction. Basically, it was muted. They had some, you know, tepid sanctions against Russia, but they didn't really have any impact. And so it became a fait accompli that Crimea is now part of Russia. And they've had tens of thousands of troops and ships and Marines and such there for years since then. In the eastern part of the Ukraine, you had these irredentist Russians who didn't like being part of the Ukraine. Well, to be fair, the land they lived on once was part of Russia, but Nikita Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, gave it to the Ukraine Soviet Social Republic back in the day, about 50 years, 60 years ago. And so they want to rejoin Russia, and what happens is that they fought a civil war. It's been ongoing since 2014, and the world really hasn't paid attention to it. And in fact, it was a civil war that included Russians disguised as local nationals coming in, fighting in the conflict, and bringing in advanced weaponry, including air defense systems, which shot down a commercial airline. I think it was a Malaysian airline, if I'm not mistaken. Killed over 340 people, if I recall correctly. And, you know, you saw pictures of people still strapped in their seats landing in a field. It was horrific. And what did Obama do? Nothing. No response. The actions that are finally being taken in the past couple days, being led by the Germans, of all people, you know, who are really going to pay a price for this because they're so dependent on the energy coming from Russia, they're the ones that are finally taking action to do something about what the Russians have done. But this is all belated. You know, last year, within 60 days of Joe Biden becoming president, Putin moved 70,000 troops to the border with the Ukraine. And what do we do? Nothing. No sanctions, no threats, no discussion, no outrage, no New York Times and Washington Post, endless articles about Russia's aggressive stance. Nobody even knew. I mean, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you, but did you guys know that we had 70,000 Russian troops move to the border in March of last year? Probably not, because the media, the fake stream, lame stream, media cover this stuff up, and the administration didn't talk about it. They're too busy telling people to put facial coverings. You know, that's their answer to everything. Wear a diaper. We'll solve world peace. You know, come on, man. Seriously. No, and so nothing happened. So what does Putin do? He's emboldened. And, you know, now people who've watched my program said, but Chris, you know, you say that he wasn't going to invade. No. What I said is if we had legitimate reporters at the White House press room, these would have been the questions asked over the last 3 months. So President Biden and Jen Circleback, as I call her, you know, Brokeback Mountain there. And also now we know her as Peppermint Patty, but Jen Psaki, whom I knew in the State Department. But anyway, so between her and Joe Biden, these are the questions should have been asked. Mr. President, you said that 127,000 troops around the border of the Ukraine from Russia would be the largest invasion since World War II. But what about the 300,000 Chinese across the Yalu River in 1950 and pushed back UN and US forces below 30th parallel? That was bigger. What about in 1973 when 900,000 Arabs and 4,000 Cubans invaded in the Yom Kippur War, attacked Israel? That's larger than 127,000. And what about 1979 when 200,000 People's Liberation Army troops came across the border and invaded Vietnam? Or 1980 when 150,000 Iraqis invaded Iran? Or here, and this one I can attest to personally because I was there. What about 1991 when 670,000 coalition troops from 43 countries, 470,000 American troops, including me, invaded Iraq to recapture Kuwait and the threat against Saudi Arabia? And just one more, and these aren't all the wars, but what about 2003 when 177,000 coalition troops invaded Iraq? The point is, that why are people asking that question? It was a stupid thing to try to scare people and turn against Russia. Not that we should be for Russia, but these are questions that deserve honest answers, and this administration wasn't being honest about it. That's just one example of how they're not honest about stuff. The list goes on and on. It's just absolutely crazy. But I mean, the story they told us. So what I told my audience is that if I were in the White House press room, I'd be asking questions like that. You know, and here's the other question. And no one can answer this clearly today. And you know why? Because in the intelligence world, the most difficult thing to figure out is intent. We can figure out troop movements. We can figure out moving target indicators. And you know, maybe satellites, maybe we have those. We can do that. And I can either confirm or deny that. But anyway, well, Carter said we have them, so I guess I can confirm that. But anyway, but the point is that you have all kinds of information which you can turn into intelligence with analysis. But I can go on for this for hours. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating. But intent is almost impossible to prove unless you know the person, and even then they could be deceiving you. So how do we know what Putin's intent is? And that's a question that should have been asked. When the last 3 months, Biden and Psaki have been saying, hey, he's going to invade, he's going to invade. Now we know he's going to invade for sure. This was a question, and I asked this question if I'd been in the White House room, press room. Why? What does he gain from invading? What does he gain? Russia is stating that they want Ukraine not to be a NATO member, and they want NATO further away from the borders. Well, if he invades Ukraine, not only does he have the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia on his border, now he's moved hundreds of miles further west, and he has NATO right next to him in Poland and Romania. That makes no sense. Ultimately, I don't know what his goal is here, but I suspect he probably would like to fix the borders a little bit at a minimum and take the eastern third of the Ukraine up to the Dnieper River, which would be more of a natural physical barrier, and you know, I don't know. But they've never addressed his intent, why he would do it. Now we see Condoleezza Rice saying, I think he's... You know, this isn't the Putin I knew. I met with him many times, and he seems a little off kilter here. Maybe he is. Maybe he's gone wacko, you know? I mean, maybe he wants $1 billion. I don't know. But Dr. Evil. But the point here is that intent, why aren't they answering that question? Because they don't know, or the narrative won't answer or address the narrative they want to push. And this is what's frustrating. The U.S.'s approach to Ukraine has been completely broken, and now I'm watching people like Alexander Vindman appear on CNN as experts on this, and I'll just stop it there.
Very good. Chris, this is some fascinating analysis. You have a show that you do. What's the best place for people to find that? How could people find it despite YouTube's efforts to hide you?
Well, YouTube makes a big effort to hide me. I have taken to using a program from the Australian Penal Colony, known as Linktree. You can find all my social media there, my published articles and my social media accounts. But for now, until PooTube comes after me again, I affectionately call them PooTube. Sorry if that offends you. But you can find me at Chris Wyatt or Chris Wyatt Africa on there. And I cover everything under the sun, a variety of topics, economics, culture, language, music, history, political science, take your pick. Focus is on Africa, but I also cover the world and do U.S. politics and any breaking geopolitical story. So I've done extensive coverage of Myanmar when the press has forgotten about Myanmar and the military junta that took over on February 1st of 2021. What are we doing there, Joe? We're not doing anything about Myanmar, are we? Central African Republic, Mozambique, the Cabo Delgado situation. You know, the list is endless. And so I cover those things, and I also focus on the U.S. from audience. But Chris Wyatt Africa on YouTube. I'm on Odyssey and Rumble as well, and I'm published in some sites in South Africa like morningshot.co.za. So for you Americans, that's ZA.
Very good. Well, Chris, thank you so much for sharing with us. Thank you for being with us. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Alex.